Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Thank you for joining us for the December 9th Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. California plans to be abortion sanctuary if Roe overturned, by Adam Bean. Douglas County, lawsuit threat follows decision, by John Aguilar. Coronavirus attacks fat tissue, scientists find, by Roni Karen Raven. COVID-19, cases spike even as U.S. hits 200 million vaccine milestones, by Sophia Turin and Jennifer McDermott. California plans to be abortion sanctuary if Roe overturned, by Adam Bean, The Associated Press, Sacramento, California. With more than two dozen states poised to ban abortion if the U.S. Supreme Court gives them the okay next year, California clinics and their allies in the legislature on Wednesday revealed a plan to make the state a sanctuary for those seeking reproductive care, including possibly paying for travel, lodging, and procedures for people from other states. The California Future of Abortion Council, made up of more than 40 abortion providers and advocacy groups, released a list of 45 recommendations for the state to consider if the High Court overturns Roe v. Wade, the 48-year-old decision that forbids states from outlawing abortion. The recommendations are not just a liberal fantasy. Some of the state's most important policymakers helped write them, including Tony Atkins, the San Diego Democrat who leads the state Senate and attended multiple meetings. Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom started the group himself, and in an interview last week with the Associated Press, said some of the report's details will be included in his budget proposal in January. "We'll be a sanctuary," Newsom said, adding he's aware patients likely will travel to California from other states to seek abortions. "We are always looking at ways to support that inevitability and looking at ways to expand our protections." Abortion, perhaps more than any other issue, has divided the country for decades along mostly traditional partisan lines. A new decision overturning Roe v. Wade, which could come next summer, would be the culmination of more than 40 years of conservative activism. But Wednesday's report offers a first glimpse of how Democratic-dominated states could respond and how the debate over abortion access would change. California already pays for abortions for many low-income residents through the state's Medicaid program. And California is one of six states that require private insurance companies to cover abortions, although many patients still end up paying deductibles and copayments. But money won't be a problem for state-funded abortion services for patients from other states. California's coffers have soared through the pandemic, fueling a record budget surplus this year. Next year, the state's independent legislative analyst office predicts California will have a surplus of about $31 billion. California's affiliates of Planned Parenthood, the nation's largest abortion provider, got a sneak preview of how people might seek abortions outside their home states this year when a Texas law that outlawed abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy was allowed to take effect. California clinics reported a slight increase in patients from Texas. Now, abortion providers are asking California to make it easier for those people to get to the state. The report recommends funding, including public spending, to support patients seeking abortion for travel expenses, such as gas, lodging, transportation, and childcare. It asks lawmakers to reimburse abortion providers for services to those who can't afford to pay, including those who travel to California from other states whose income is low enough that they would qualify for state-funded abortions under Medicaid if they live there. It's unclear how many people would travel to California for abortions if Roe v. Wade is overturned. California does not collect or report abortion statistics. The Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights, said 132,680 abortions were performed in California in 2017, or about 15% of all abortions nationally. That number includes people from out of state, as well as teenagers who are not required to have their parents' permission for an abortion in California. Planned Parenthood, which accounts for about half of California's abortion clinics, said it serves 7,000 people from other states last year. "We're looking at how to build capacity and build workforce," said Jody Hicks, CEO of Planned Parenthood. "It will take a partnership and investment with the state." Douglas County, lawsuit threat follows decision. School district drops mask mandate. Parent says she plans to sue, by John Aguilar, The Denver Post. The battle over masks in schools that has defined much of the fall semester in the Douglas County School District likely will stretch into winter, with at least one parent of a student with disabilities vowing to take the district to court after the school board's decision early Wednesday to drop universal masking. "I will 100% be suing," said Kate Gould, mother to a fourth grader at Heritage Elementary School in Highlands Ranch. Gould said she felt profound sadness, profound anger, in the wake of the Douglas County School Board's decision to end a mask mandate that she insists is critical to protecting her son against catching coronavirus, which she said could trigger severe illness or be fatal, given his compromised lung function as a child with cystic fibrosis. "My son worked so hard to stay healthy," she said Wednesday. Gould is one of nine parents of children with disabilities who, along with the Douglas County School District, sued the Douglas County Health Department in federal court in October. The lawsuit came when the newly formed department decided students and staff members did not have to wear masks in schools, saying that parents should have the ultimate say over their children's health. A federal judge in Denver ruled that the county's mask opt-out violated the Americans with Disabilities Act and declared it invalid. But last month, a new conservative-leaning school board dominated by candidates opposed to mask mandates was elected. After a marathon meeting Tuesday night that stretched past midnight and featured a majority of speakers opposing the district's mandatory masking approach, the board dropped the policy by a 4-3 vote. The board's decision takes effect immediately. School Board President Mike Peters, part of the new majority on the board, said it's about striking a proper balance between providing all students with equal access to an education without unfairly burdening 64,000 students with the requirement they all mask up. The district was unable to provide numbers on how many students chose to uncover their faces Wednesday. "We expect superintendents and district staff, once they identify students who need accommodations, to work with them individually," Peter said. "We want to make decisions as close to the student as possible. Decisions being made at the lowest level are the best, rather than one-size-fits-all mandates." Opponents of mask mandates say masks are not without their own harms when it comes to blocking visual cues critical to learning, especially among younger students. Even the World Health Organization has issued guidance that children under age 6 should not be masked, and for those 6 to 11 years old, the agency cautions that mask use should be tempered by a number of factors, including the potential impact of mask wearing on learning and psychosocial development. One person under age 18 has died from COVID-19 in Douglas County since the pandemic started in March 2020, according to data from the Tri-County Health Department. "This vote was an attempt to reestablish parental choice around their children," Peter said. Those supporting covered faces in schools point out that Douglas County remains in a state of high virus transmission and that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends universal masking inside school buildings for students and staffers. They also note that 98.7% of intensive care unit beds are occupied in Douglas County. Jen Alexander, who was also a plaintiff in the federal lawsuit against Douglas County this fall, said she understands parent frustration about having to mask their children. But she said if her third-grade daughter, who attends a charter school in Parker and has epilepsy, catches coronavirus, the chances of severe neurological complications would be likely. We have to send our kids to school terrified, Alexander said. In my opinion, masks are a reasonable accommodation to protect the vulnerable. She kept her daughter home Wednesday in the wake of the school board's policy change, saying she doesn't know how the school district can accommodate her without segregating her from her classmates. Gould said that's what's happened to her son at Heritage Elementary. On Wednesday, he was placed across the room from the rest of the students. She said she staged a sit-in inside the school's lobby Wednesday morning to demand that the students in her son's classroom be masked. We, as special needs parents, had less than 8 hours to figure out if we send our children to school today, Gould said. Gould said she doesn't know how many of the other 9 parents involved in the earlier lawsuit might join in a new lawsuit against the district. In a strange twist, they will no longer have the help of attorneys from the Douglas County School District who argued on their behalf in federal court in October because the board no longer supports mask mandates. The financial burden is going to fall on the special needs families, she said. Coronavirus attacks fat tissue, scientists find, by Roni Karen Rabin, The New York Times Company. From the start of the pandemic, the coronavirus seemed to target people carrying extra pounds. Patients who were overweight or obese were more likely to develop severe COVID-19 and more likely to die. Although these patients often have health conditions such as diabetes that compound their risk, scientists have become increasingly convinced their vulnerability has something to do with obesity itself. Now, researchers have found the coronavirus infects fat cells and certain immune cells within body fat, prompting a damaging defensive response in the body. The bottom line is, indeed, the virus can infect fat cells directly, said Philip Scherr, a scientist who studies fat cells at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, who was not involved in the research. Whatever happens in fat doesn't stay in fat, he added. It affects the neighboring tissues as well. The research has not yet been peer-reviewed or published in a scientific journal, but it was posted online in October. If the findings hold up, they may shed light on not just why patients with excess pounds are vulnerable to the virus, but also on why certain younger adults with no other risks become so ill. The study's authors suggested the evidence could point to new COVID-19 treatments that target body fat. Maybe that's the Achilles heel that the virus uses to evade our protective immune responses by hiding in this place, said Dr. Vishwa Diab Dixit, a professor of comparative medicine and immunology at Yale School of Medicine. The finding is particularly relevant to the United States, which has one of the highest rates of obesity in the world. Most American adults are overweight, and 42% have obesity. Black, Latino, Native American, and Alaska Native people in the U.S. have higher obesity rates than white adults and Asian Americans. They also have been affected disproportionately by the pandemic, with death rates almost double those of white Americans. This could well be contributing to severe disease, said Dr. Catherine Blish, a professor at Stanford University Medical Center and one of the report's 2 senior authors. We're seeing the same inflammatory cytokines that I see in the blood of the really sick patients being produced in response to infection of those tissues. Body fat used to be thought of as inert, a form of storage. But scientists now know that the tissue is biologically active, producing hormones and immune system proteins that act on other cells, promoting a state of nagging low-grade inflammation even when there is no infection. Inflammation is the body's response to an invader, and sometimes it can be so vigorous that it is more harmful than the infection that triggered it. Fat tissue is composed mostly of fat cells, or adipocytes. It also contains pre-adipocytes, which mature into fat cells, and a variety of immune cells, including a type of adipose tissue called macrophages. Blish, with colleagues at Stanford and in Germany and Switzerland, carried out experiments to see if fat tissue obtained from bariatric surgery patients could become infected with the coronavirus and tracked how various types of cells responded. The fat cells themselves could become infected, the scientists found, yet did not become very inflamed. But certain immune cells called macrophages could also be infected, and they developed a robust inflammatory response. Even stranger, the pre-adipocytes were not infected, but contributed to the inflammatory response. The scientists did not examine whether particular variants were more destructive in this regard than others. The research team also obtained fat tissue from the bodies of European patients who had died of COVID-19 and discovered the coronavirus in fat near various organs. The idea that adipose tissue might serve as a reservoir for pathogens is not new, Dixit said. Body fat is known to harbor a number of them, including HIV and the influenza virus. The coronavirus appears to be able to evade the body fat's immune defenses, which are limited and incapable of fighting it effectively. And in people who are obese, there can be a lot of body fat. A man whose ideal weight is 170 pounds, but who weighs 250 pounds, is carrying a substantial amount of fat in which the virus may hang out, replicate, and trigger a destructive immune system response, said Dr. David Cass, a professor of cardiology at Johns Hopkins. If you really are very obese, fat is the biggest single organ in your body, Cass said. The coronavirus can infect that tissue and actually reside there, he said. Whether it hurts it, kills it, or at best, it's a place to amplify itself, it doesn't matter. It becomes kind of a reservoir. As the inflammatory response snowballs, cytokines trigger even more inflammation and the release of additional cytokines. It's like a perfect storm, Cass said. Bliss and her colleagues speculated that infected body fat may even contribute to long COVID-19, a condition describing troublesome symptoms like fatigue that persists for weeks or months after recovery from an acute episode. The data also suggests that COVID-19 vaccines and treatments may need to take into account the patient's weight and fat stores. This paper is another wake-up call for the medical profession and public health to look more deeply into the issues of overweight and obese individuals and the treatments and vaccines we're giving them, said Barry Popkin, a professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina, who has studied the heightened risk that COVID-19 poses to those with obesity. We keep documenting the risks they have, but we still aren't addressing it, Popkin said. COVID-19. Cases spike even as U.S. hits 200 million vaccine milestone, by Sophia Turin and Jennifer McDermott, the Associated Press, Byline, Providence, Rhode Island. The number of Americans fully vaccinated against COVID-19 reached 200 million Wednesday amid a dispiriting holiday season spike in cases and hospitalizations that has hit even New England, one of the most highly inoculated corners of the country. New cases in the U.S. climbed from an average of nearly 95,000 a day on November 22nd to almost 119,000 a day this week. And hospitalizations are up 25% from a month ago. The increases are almost entirely the result of the Delta variant, although the Omicron mutation has been detected in about 20 states and is sure to spread. Deaths are running close to 1,600 a day on average, back up to where they were in October. And the overall U.S. death toll, less than 2 years into the crisis, could hit another heartbreaking milestone, 800,000, in a matter of days. The situation is not as dire as last year's holiday season surge before the public had access to COVID-19 vaccines. But the 60% of the U.S. population that is fully vaccinated has not been enough to prevent hotspots. The cold weather, Thanksgiving gatherings, and a big rebound in holiday travel are all believed to be playing a role, along with public weariness with pandemic restrictions. Lawrence Gostin, director of the WHO Collaborating Center on Public Health Law and Human Rights at Georgetown University, likened the virus to a wildfire. You can clear a forest of the shrubbery, but if you leave some shrubs and trees standing, the fire will find them, Gostin said. The virus will find you. It is searching for hosts that are not immune. The fact that you live in New England or New York doesn't insulate you. Demand for the vaccine, with recent approval of boosters for all adults and shots for elementary school children, has been high amid the surge and the emergence of the Omicron variant, whose dangers are still not fully understood. Nearly 48 million people have received a booster, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. White House officials noted the U.S. administered 12.5 million shots last week, the highest weekly total since May. And that's critical progress as we head into the winter and confront the new Omicron variant, White House coronavirus advisor Jeffrey Zients said. At the same time, some states, notably in highly vaccinated New England, but also in the Midwest, are grappling with some of the worst surges since the start of the pandemic. Hospitals are filling up and reacting by canceling non-urgent surgeries or taking other crisis measures, while states are promoting boosters strongly. Despite one of the highest vaccination levels in the country, more than 74% of the population fully vaccinated, Vermont is coping with its biggest surge yet. In the past week, new cases per day are up 54%, and the number of people in the hospital with COVID-19 has climbed 18%. The virus is preying on those who haven't gotten their shots. As of Tuesday, 90% of COVID-19 patients in intensive care were unvaccinated. Obviously, it's not where we want to be, Governor Phil Scott said Tuesday, calling the situation extremely frustrating. More than 400 people were in the hospital with COVID-19 in New Hampshire at the start of the week, breaking the record set last winter. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu directed hospitals to set up COVID-19 surge centers using space normally reserved for such things as outpatient care. Every day for the next several weeks, we're likely to see a new high in COVID hospitalizations in New Hampshire, said Steve Ahnen, president of the New Hampshire Hospital Association. With over 1,000 new cases a day, that number's not going to do anything but continue to go up. Maine likewise is struggling with record-breaking COVID-19 hospitalizations. Governor Janet Mills on Wednesday activated as many as 75 members of the National Guard to help out. The vast majority of patients in our hospitals are unvaccinated. That's especially true of critical care patients, said Andy Mueller, CEO of Maine Health, the state's biggest health network. It requires a tremendous amount of our resources to provide care. Rhode Island's largest hospital system, Lifespan, said staffing shortages are at never-before-seen crisis levels, while Kent Hospital said it is near capacity and is considering delaying non-urgent procedures. Dr. Perry Gopalakrishnan, Kent's interim president and chief operating officer, said the spike is probably the result of people letting their guard down during the holidays, and flu season could complicate things further. New Hampshire plans to hold a booster blitz on Saturday at 15 locations. Most appointments were booked. In Berlin, Vermont, Mike Labowney got his booster Tuesday. I have friends that are in their 20s that are getting sick and friends that are 60 that are getting sick, he said. The thing you see on Facebook and stuff like that is, I just want this to be over. I'm very sick, so I'm just trying to avoid that. Elsewhere around the country, Indiana has seen COVID-19 hospital admissions double in the past month and is approaching levels not seen since this time a year ago, before vaccines were widely available. The number of people in intensive care in Minnesota has reached the highest level yet during the pandemic, with 98% of ICU beds occupied. Teams of military medics have been sent into Michigan and New Mexico. Senate rejects vaccine mandate for businesses. By Kevin Freiking, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. The Senate narrowly approved a resolution Wednesday to nullify the Biden administration's requirement that businesses with 100 or more workers have their employees be vaccinated against the coronavirus or submit to weekly testing. The vote was 52 to 48. The Democratic-led House is unlikely to take up the measure, which means the mandate would stand, though courts have put it on hold for now. Still, the vote gave senators a chance to voice opposition to a policy they say has sparked fears back home from businesses and from unvaccinated constituents who worry about losing their jobs should the rule go into effect. Every so often, Washington, D.C. does something that lights up the phone lines. This is one of those moments, said Senator Steve Daines, Republican of Montana. At home, he said, this issue is what I hear about. This issue is a top-of-mind issue. Lawmakers can invalidate certain federal agency regulations if a joint resolution is approved by both houses of Congress and signed by the president, or if Congress overrides a presidential veto. That's unlikely to happen in this case. Under the rule, private sector companies with 100 or more workers must require their employees to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 or be tested for the virus weekly and wear masks on the job. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration said it would work with companies on compliance, but would fine them up to more than $13,000 for each violation, although implementation and enforcement is suspended as the litigation unfolds. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, said Americans who have refused to get vaccinated are the biggest impediment to ending the pandemic. He implied that some of the resistance to mandated vaccines is based on politics. Some of the anti-vaxxers here in this chamber remind me of what happened 400 years ago when people were clinging to the fact that the sun revolved around the earth. They just didn't believe science. Or 500 years ago, when they were sure the earth was flat, Schumer said. Schumer said social media has played a role in spreading falsehoods about the vaccine, and so has the far right. He urged senators to vote against the resolution, sponsored by Senator Mike Braun, a Republican of Indiana. Republicans said they are supportive of the vaccine, but that the mandate amounts to government overreach. His mandates are under fire in the courts. Main Street job creators are complaining against it. And tonight, the U.S. Senate must send a clear message. Back off this bad idea, Braun said. I think, actually, the mandate has made it worse in terms of hardening people who don't want to be told what to do by the government, said Senator John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming. Some January 6th rioters may use police brutality as a defense. By Alan Feuer, the New York Times Company. With the first trials connected to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol set to begin early next year, defense lawyers have started in earnest to road test strategies for defeating the government's charges. Some, in the most complicated cases, will most likely challenge the allegation that an organized conspiracy to storm the building predated any violence. Others, looking to offload the blame their clients face, may contend that they were authorized by President Donald Trump to take part in the attack. But one group of lawyers representing those accused of assaulting the police is planning to make a more audacious and more difficult legal claim. They say they intend to argue that the officers themselves used excessive force January 6th and that their clients merely responded, acting in defense of other people or in their own defense. This approach, while in its early stages, has gathered steam in recent weeks as defense lawyers have made their way through thousands of hours of videos of the Capitol attack, some of which they say show acts of brutality by officers. The videos, which are not yet public, may be released at upcoming hearings, and the lawyers say will reveal scenes of violence not only by the rioters, but also by police. Although often hard to prove, self-defense claims have figured prominently in two high-profile recent cases with varying levels of effectiveness. Last month, a jury in Wisconsin rendered a verdict showing it believed Kyle Rittenhouse's claims of self-defense and acquitted him of all charges connected to the fatal shootings of two men and the wounding of another during a violent confrontation on the streets of Kenosha in August 2020. A few days later, a Georgia jury rejected the self-defense arguments of three men charged with murdering Ahmaud Arbery and found them guilty. At this point, about a half dozen January 6 defendants have signaled that they intend to mount a case that is based on self-defense or on the defense of others. On Thursday, for example, a lawyer for Thomas Webster, a former New York City police officer charged with assault, indicated that he was inclined to pursue a self-defense case and argued that officers at the Capitol struck first. That same day, prosecutors filed papers in the case of Robert Geiswine, a militia member from Colorado, asking a judge to bar all self-defense claims at a trial set for February, suggesting that they believed that Geiswine might raise them. Any defendant who argues self-defense or defense of others most likely will face an uphill battle. Judges and prosecutors have looked askance at the claims, with prosecutors in one case noting in court papers that they were simply not credible. Indeed, for such defenses to be viable, the violators will have to persuade a judge and jury that they or others in the mob at the Capitol were victims of unlawful attacks by the police. That could be difficult given that so much of the rioters' own violent behavior was caught on video and that officers were justified in using some amount of force in the performance of their jobs. Most of the defendants mulling self-defense claims were involved in the melee at the Lower West Terrace of the Capitol, where the fighting was worse than anywhere else January 6th and often resembled a kind of medieval warfare. For nearly 3 hours, officers there were engaged in hand-to-hand combat with rioters, some of them carrying flagpoles, hockey sticks, bear spray, and batons. The first person to have said he would pursue a self-defense case was Edward Jacob Lang, a self-described social media influencer from New York. He has been charged with 7 counts of assaulting officers, some with a riot shield and others with a baseball bat. In court papers filed by his lawyer, Stephen Metcalf, Lang said he became violent only after seeing several women in the mob being attacked by the police, including Roseanne Boylan, a Trump supporter who ultimately died. Lang has claimed that he tried unsuccessfully to save Boylan and has said he pulled another protester, Philip Anderson, to safety after he was sprayed by officers with a gas. The police were heartlessly pushing people on top of each other, creating this dogpile effect, Lang said in a brief interview from a jail in Washington this month, and people ended up dying. A few weeks ago, Ryan Nichols, a former Marine from Texas, also asserted he was acting in self-defense and in defense of others when he assaulted the police. In his own court papers, Nichols described an horrific scene inside the tunnel at the Lower West Terrace, where tear gas filled the air and screaming rioters were being crushed. The papers describe a video that purports to show an officer in a white shirt in the crowd near Nichols beating one man with his collapsible baton and turning his attention to a middle-aged woman with a MAGA hat to pulverize her. As Nichols' lawyer, Joseph McBride, wrote, over the course of 4 or 5 minutes, according to the description of the video, the white-shirted officer appears to strike the woman multiple times until blood spurts from her face and she collapses. Last week, the government countered Nichols' claims, saying that other video evidence shows he was not near the white-shirted officer and was not in a position to observe or be triggered by any attack against the woman in question. The prosecutors argued that Nichols' attempt to cast himself as a hero who was merely fighting back against officers who were terrorizing civilians was preposterous. Lang's claims have been met with equal skepticism. At a hearing in September, Judge Carl J. Nichols pointed out that even after January 6th, Lange was still using violent language. Nichols noted, for example, that in messages sent to an unknown associate, Lange wrote that he was getting an arsenal together for Joe Biden's inauguration, adding, "This is war." Despite the fact that some officers may have acted roughly, Nichols said, Lange was in the mob, sparring with them for more than an hour before he sought to help Boylan or Anderson. In news briefs, Meadows sues House Committee, byline Washington. Former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows on Wednesday sued the House Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection as the chairman of the panel pledged to move forward with contempt charges against him for defying a subpoena. The dueling actions laid bare simmering tensions between the committee and Meadows and reflected a remarkable turnabout from last week when Meadows' lawyer had declared his intention of cooperating with the committee on certain areas of their inquiry. Meadows' lawsuit asked the judge to invalidate two subpoenas that he says are overly broad and unduly burdensome. It accuses the committee of overreaching by issuing a subpoena to Verizon for his cell phone records. Leaking oil pipes, safeguards not working fully, byline Los Angeles. The ruptured offshore pipeline that spilled tens of thousands of gallons of crude oil off the California coast this fall did not have a functioning leak detection system, according to a report compiled by pipeline operator Beta Offshore. The company is investigating whether personnel or control room issues contributed to the accident, but does not explain what was wrong with the detection system. India's top military general dies in helicopter crash, byline New Delhi. General Bipin Rawat, India's highest-ranking military official, leading efforts to modernize the country's armed forces, died in a helicopter crash Wednesday with his wife and 11 others, officials said. His death was confirmed in a statement by the country's defense minister, Rajnath Singh, after hours of uncertainty as senior officials rushed to the crash site in the southern state of Tamil Nadu and the victims were taken to a hospital. Japanese tourists dock at International Space Station, byline Moscow. Fashion tycoon Yusaku Masuwa and producer Yoizo Hirano rocketed into space on Wednesday and reached the International Space Station several hours later, a first visit by self-paying space tourists to the orbiting outpost in more than a decade. They blasted off for the International Space Station in a Russian Soyuz spacecraft with Russian cosmonaut Alexander Misurkin. Strahan spice flight delayed. TV celebrity and former football great Michael Strahan is going to have to wait another few days before rocketing into space. Strahan was supposed to blast off Thursday from West Texas with five others for a 10-minute flight. But on Wednesday, Blue Origin bumped the launch to Saturday because of high wind. Scott Peterson resentenced to life term in wife's 2002 death. Byline, Sacramento, California. Nearly 17 years after being sentenced to die, Scott Peterson was resentenced to life without parole Wednesday during an emotional hearing in which family members of his slain pregnant wife, Lacey, called him out for the Christmas Eve killing in 2002 and his apparent lack of remorse. Lacey's mother, Sharon Rocha, addressed Peterson directly as he sat expressionless. "I still feel the grief every day after 19 years. Your evil, self-centered, unforgivable, selfish act ended two beautiful souls. And for what reason? There was no reason other than you just didn't want them anymore. You didn't want a baby, nor the responsibility of being a father. You're a coward." These reports were from Denver Post Wire Services. RMNP Ranger wounded in shootout. Officials closed one of Rocky Mountain National Park's entrances Wednesday after a ranger and a driver exchanged gunfire nearby. A park ranger made a traffic stop at about 10:15 a.m. near the park's Fall River entrance on U.S. 34, and the ranger and a person in the car exchanged gunfire, State Patrol spokesman Trooper Josh Lewis said. The ranger was shot, But the bullet was stopped by the ranger's ballistic vest, which prevented serious injury. Rocky Mountain National Park spokeswoman Kyle Patterson said in a news release, "One of the suspects was wounded in the gunfire and transported to a hospital. The other suspect was not injured and was taken into custody. The driver and the passenger were reported to be involved in a vehicle pursuit earlier Wednesday morning outside the park," Patterson said. Park officials, after the shooting, closed the Fall River entrance and the stretch of US 34 between the entrance and Deer Ridge Junction. The entrance remained closed Wednesday afternoon. "The FBI will lead the investigation into the incident," Patterson said. This was by Elise Schmelzer, the Denver Post. Thornton mayor to run for Congress. Thornton Mayor Jan Kuhlman, a Republican, announced Tuesday she is running for the newly created 8th Congressional District. She joins a crowded field vying to represent Colorado's newest and most politically competitive congressional district. Kuhlman, in the announcement, describes herself as an engineer and trailblazer in the oil and gas industry, advocate for parental school choice, and local official who beat back a recall by left-wing activists in Thornton in 2016. The lion's share of the newly created district, sprung from Colorado's population boom, takes in parts of Adams and Weld counties and covers heavily suburban areas along with farm and ranch land north of Denver. "I'm an oil and gas engineer, a mayor, and a mom. Solving problems is what I do," Kuhlman said. She also promises to reestablish America's energy independence. This was from Kiernan Nicholson, the Denver Post. Denver drivers spending an average of 40 hours in traffic. Study finds metro area ranks 15th in the U.S. in time lost to congestion. By John Murray, the Denver Post. Metro Denver's traffic congestion is on track to be the 15th worst in the nation this year, a new study concluded, despite commuters losing less time to gridlock than they did before the pandemic. Drivers in the metro area will spend an average 40 hours stuck in traffic in 2021, according to the Global Traffic Scorecard released Tuesday by INRIX Research, a global mobility data company. That's up from 24 hours last year, when the rapid onset of the pandemic resulted in stay-at-home orders that cleared area highways of congestion for a time. This year's average time in traffic still is on pace to fall short of the 63 hours that INRIX estimated the average driver spent in 2019, a 36% gap. The company's analysts based the calculation on congestion tracking during the first 10 months of 2021. The pandemic continues to scramble many commute patterns, transportation experts say, with rush hours spiking less severely and traffic volume spread more evenly throughout the day. Many of the white-collar workers who normally would commute to downtowns each day still are working from home or have adjusted to hybrid schedules. Nonetheless, Denver's rush hours have notably returned as more office workers have resumed commuting, and the rankings show traffic is returning faster than in some similarly choked cities. Denver's 15th place ranking came in higher than its number 16 spot in INRIX's 2020 list and its number 21 ranking in 2019. Nationally, the average driver will spend 64% less time in traffic this year compared to 2 years ago, INRIX found. New York City ranked first for congestion impact with 102 hours of congestion delay, followed by Chicago, 104 hours, and Philadelphia, 90 hours. The impact rankings are weighted by city size. Perennial congestion leader Boston came in fourth, with its average time spent in traffic at 78 hours, still 47% below the pre-pandemic level. The most notable change to commuting during the pandemic, other than reduced travel times and volumes, was the lack of downtown travel. Bob Pishu, an INRIX transportation analyst, said in a news release. In that analysis, Denver is running closer to pre-pandemic levels than most cities. INRIX estimated downtown trips were 10% below 2019 levels in Denver this year, compared to an average 22% below normal nationally. A big caveat for Denver is that road travel has recovered much more quickly than transit ridership, which remains below 60% of pre-pandemic levels, according to data from the Regional Transportation District. That means commuters are more willing to drive than board a train or bus. Less overall congestion has had some deadly consequences, with experts citing higher speeds as a likely factor in the growth of fatal crashes. While many countries in Western Europe reported fewer fatalities on streets and motorways, early estimates from the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration show that January to June 2021 recorded the largest 6 months fatality increase in history, an 18.4% jump over 2020, Pichu wrote in a blog post this week. The Colorado Department of Transportation said last week that 2021 was on track to be the deadliest year in Colorado roads since 2004, with 617 road fatalities so far. Ghost guns. Denver to consider outlawing homemade, untraceable weapons, by Elise Schmelzer, The Denver Post. Denver's top leaders want to ban untraceable, homemade ghost guns from the city to stop the weapons influx as they become more common nationwide. Ghost guns are firearms without serial numbers that can be assembled at home from kits purchased online or created using 3D printers, City Attorney Kristen Bronson said Wednesday at a meeting of the City Council's Safety, Housing, Education, and Homelessness Committee. Her office, with the support of Mayor Michael Hancock, is asking the City Council to pass an ordinance that would prohibit the possession, use, or manufacturing of any gun without a serial number. If the law is passed, people caught with a ghost gun would face up to 300 days in jail and a $999 fine. Cities across America are seeing a dramatic increase in the number of crimes involving ghost guns, and Denver is not immune, Bronson said. A person who would otherwise be banned from purchasing a gun legally, an underage teen, a felon, or someone under a red flag law order, can currently evade gun laws by purchasing non-serialized parts or ghost gun kits. The guns are problematic because buyers do not undergo a background check or have to meet minimum age requirements for purchasing a gun, Senior Assistant City Attorney Reginald Neubein said. And law enforcement cannot trace the gun's purchase or ownership history because the guns do not have a serial number. Selling build-at-home gun kits is legal under federal law, but some states have passed legislation to restrict their use. Websites for companies that sell the kits online boast of circumventing paperwork needed to purchase guns with serial numbers and the privacy of an unregistered purchase. One seller's website states building the guns takes only a few hours, and they can often be delivered within a week. If you can build IKEA furniture, you can make one of these weapons yourself, Neubein said. Federal law enforcement agencies recovered 23,906 ghost guns from 2016 to 2020, according to the U.S. Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. The number confiscated increased every year from 1,750 collected in 2016 to 8,712 in 2020. Officers found 325 of the guns at scenes of homicides or attempted homicides, according to the ATF. Denver police have confiscated 38 ghost guns since November 2019, although the number of guns in the city is likely much higher, Neubein said. The ghost guns represent about 2% of the 1,907 guns seized during that time. While our numbers are not that high, ghost guns are being used to commit crimes in Denver, and we are trying to get ahead of that curve, Bronson said. Denver police on Wednesday could not immediately provide information about what types of crimes the confiscated ghost guns were connected with, department spokeswoman Christine Downs said. The department does not take positions on proposed municipal legislation, she said. City Council members signaled strong support for the ordinance change during the committee meeting Wednesday. the Committee of Seven unanimously voted to forward the proposal to the full council for a vote. It's kind of scary to think how easy it is for our talented kids to put together weapons in the privacy of their homes, so we're moving forward as quickly as possible, Councilman Paul Cashman said during the meeting. One of the goals of the legislation is to pressure companies that sell build-at-home gun kits to start using serial numbers, Newbine said. New York City, San Diego, and Philadelphia are among 8 U.S. cities that have passed similar legislation. The more local jurisdictions who enact laws like this will cause a change in the market for these weapons, Newbine said. We want to cause some disruption in the market. The proposed ordinance also mirrors efforts at the federal level to close the loophole that allows ghost guns to escape regulation. The U.S. Department of Justice in May asked the ATF to update its definition of a firearm to include ghost guns, noting that gun technology has evolved radically since the definition was written 50 years ago. Current regulations mandate a serial number be printed on a gun's frame or receiver, the part that brings together the hammer, bolt, and firing mechanism. Guns used by the general public at the time the regulations were written were primarily single-framed firearms. Many guns now are more complex and have multi-part frames or receivers, which can be sold separately or unassembled, thus circumventing the regulations because the unassembled parts do not constitute a firearm under federal law. Colorado, sorely needed dump of fresh snow headed for ski areas, by John Meyer, The Denver Post. A storm system that has been tracked anxiously by powder-starved skiers and snowboarders for days is shaping up with the potential to deliver significant mountain snowfall across the high country, according to the Open Snow Mountain Forecasting and Tracking Service. Most resorts can expect 6 to 12 inches overnight Thursday into Friday morning, according to Open Snow founding meteorologist Joel Gratz, and some areas could see more than 20 inches. This storm will help our snowpack, and more terrain should open, Gratz wrote in his daily forecast on Wednesday. This storm by itself won't get our snowpack back to average. We're currently around 50% of average, but at least it'll keep us from setting a low snowpack record for now. Wolf Creek could be the big winner, with Open Snow forecasting 26 inches up there. Other big dumps are forecast for Powderhorn and Steamboat, 22 inches, Crested Butte, 21 inches, Telluride, 19 inches, Purgatory, 18 inches, Beaver Creek, 17 inches, Snowmass, 16 inches, and Vail, 14 inches. Other resorts, including Loveland, Winter Park, and Eldora, can expect 5 to 8 inches. While the timing is still in flux, the most intense snow should be between about Thursday at midnight through Friday between sunrise and noon, Gratz wrote. During some of this time, we'll see snowfall rates of 1 to 2 inches per hour, thanks to a combination of a lot of moisture, a cold front at the ground, and the jet stream overhead. The cold front and the jet stream act to lift the moist air and turn the moisture into snow. On Thursday night into Friday morning, the cold front will help all mountains see intense snow, and temperatures will rapidly drop into the single digits on Friday morning. Just in time for the fresh snow this weekend, CDOT resumes its weekend snow-staying bus service to Loveland, Arapahoe Basin, and Steamboat Springs on Saturday. New this year, snow-staying will also serve Copper Mountain. Buses to Steamboat leave Saturday morning and return Sunday, requiring an overnight stay. Service to Loveland, Arapahoe Basin, and Copper runs Saturdays and Sundays. The round trip cost is $25 to Loveland, Arapahoe Basin, and Copper Mountain. The round trip cost for Steamboat is $40. Snow staying was inaugurated in the winter of 2019-20, but was suspended last winter because of COVID-19. CEO says he's deeply sorry for firing workers over Zoom, by Derek Bryson Tyler and Jenny Gross, The New York Times Company. The chief executive of the mortgage leader Better.com has apologized for the way he laid off about 900 employees over Zoom last week, saying that he blundered the execution. In a letter to employees dated Tuesday, the executive Vishal Garg wrote that he failed to show the appropriate amount of respect and appreciation for those who were laid off. In doing so, I embarrassed you, he wrote in a letter, which was published on Better.com's website. Last week, Garg announced over a Zoom call that about 9% of the staff would be laid off. This is the second time in my career I'm doing this, and I do not want to do this, he said on the call, recordings of which were widely shared online. The last time I did it, I cried. This time I hope to be stronger. He said employees were being laid off for reasons including the market, performance, and productivity. If you're on this call, you're part of the unlucky group that was being laid off, he said. Your employment here is terminated effective immediately. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.